Good morning. My name's Janice Jones. I'm your chair this morning. I'll briefly introduce Nicolette, but having asked a controversial question of the plenary speaker this morning, she's raised her profile significantly and we've sold out the room, which is great to see. Nicolette is the General Manager of Strategy at Colonial First State, where she's responsible for developing their strategy in conjunction with the management team, the business planning, advocacy and CEO. Prior to that, she's had experience at BT and Towers Perrin and started her career as an actuarial analyst in South Africa. She's currently on the ASFA board and chair of the FPA Strategic Marketing Committee, so she's well qualified to talk to superannuation, both retail and more generally across the sector. And she's speaking today on retail and industry funds. Assures me she's going to dispel some rumours and myth, so we'll see which ones are being dispelled this morning. Nicolette's presentation runs for around 30 minutes, so we will only have 5 to 10 minutes for questions at the end, so please hold your questions. And just a word of warning that when it's question time, you will have to come forward to roughly where John Moroney's sitting or to this podium to ask your question to ensure it's recorded, and please introduce yourself, as you're well aware. Mobile phones, last chance, make sure they're off. And thank you, Nicolette.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Now, I chose this topic because retail funds have had a bit of a hard time out there, and Alan Collar did a good job of demonstrating that this morning. So there are a few myths that I would like to try and address. And at the end of the day, the myths have come about because of various methodologies and interpretation of data. So I did think, what better place to demonstrate that or address that as an actuarial conference? And I also think that it's only actuaries that are going to be able to sit through this amount of data and graphs and tables. I am very interested in feedback from the audience. So be it via questions afterwards or, you know, coming to have a chat or sending me an email, as I said, I'm very interested. The final comment I'd like to make before I start is my intention is not to bag out industry funds in this presentation. It's more to address the myths as they relate to retail funds. There are some very good industry funds out there, and some of whom are at this conference, and a lot of whom are clients of Colonial First State. So hopefully you'll see I do try to present a balanced argument, and really I'm trying to demonstrate that the poles don't exist that are often portrayed, and that actually there's more similarities than differences. Okay, don't believe a word I say. okay, so in terms of an outline, I'm going to give a bit of background, look at a retail case study, and I've chosen First Choice, then look at a industry level investment performance, industry level fees, then look at what else goes into the superannuation equation, and then finish off. So first of all, a bit of a backdrop, and without being boring, the best place to start is the APRA data, just on the size of the various parts of the market. So retail funds still have the largest share of the market. This is just showing assets in the various funds over time. Retail funds have about 32% of the market, followed by self-managed super funds. You can see, actually, even from that experience, the most growth. They've got about 27%. Industry funds at about 18%, and industry funds have actually grown from, you can see in December 2000, being the fifth largest category to the third largest category. Public sector funds at about 16% and corporate funds at about 6%. Then we've had since Choice has been introduced, we've had the industry fund advertising campaign focused on fees and the compare the pair, with a huge spend at about $20 million per annum being spent on that. Based on our own brand tracking, it has absolutely been effective, and it is very much infiltrated your sort of average consumer awareness. So, and sort of another key thing to note in terms of what's happened is the release last year of APRA's data over looking at the previous 10 years that showed that investment performance of the various sectors, and I've just circled for you there the industry funds, which some of you at the back can't see, but industry funds over the 10 years, 6.7%, and retail funds at 5.3%. So showing a difference of 1.4% per annum difference in returns. not looking good. And as a result, you know, this is some of the media that we've had. Obviously very pro not-for-profit funds and quite anti-retail in a lot of cases. So the next question to ask is, well, how has those sort of changes in brand perceptions and some of that media been impacting how people are actually moving their superannuation? And one way of looking at that is this switching data. So this is Roy Morgan data. It's actually a consumer survey-based approach. And they look at, you can see by group, the percentage of switches gained for each player, percentage lost, and then a net figure is the column on the right-hand side. The first thing I should just note about this data is that it actually shows a very low percentage of switching overall, 3.5% of people switching their superannuation in a 12-month period. And just as an aside, ASFA commissioned ANOP to do research, and they put that figure at 16% per annum. So kind of poles apart. But coming back to this data and asking, well, you know, who's winning and who's losing, if you like, it's a bit of a mixed bag at best. You can see we've got four retail players that have positive net switching figures and four that have negative net switching figures. So Colonial First State is captured within the Commonwealth group there. If you look at the industry fund figure at minus 1.3%, so they got a negative figure, but it's worth pointing out that that was actually the first time that that's happened since this data was released, that they've actually had positive figures each quarter when the data gets reported. And I think it went negative mainly because of the million-dollar opportunity around 30th of June last year, which probably favoured retail funds. The other thing to point out here is public sector funds and self-managed funds actually have the most positive net switching figures. Now, the thing about this is that it's number of switches, it's not dollars, so it doesn't really tell you the whole story. And if anyone has, I've not actually seen any dollar-based figures on net switches, so I'd be interested in if anybody else has. So really, to assess dollars, you have to come back to the APRA data. And what I've shown here is the net contribution flows from the APRA data, and from the self-managed super fund stat there is an ATO figure, I think. So that is an all-encompassing employer contributions, personal contributions, rollovers in, less rollovers out, and less benefit payments. Now, if you look, retail funds are still getting the highest flows, and if you look at those flows as a percentage of the total flows, they're maintaining market share, so around that 32% figure. Whereas self-managed super funds and industry funds are both getting a higher percentage of flows than their natural market share, and public sector and corporate lower than their... And as you can see there, the corporate fund figure is actually in outflow. So at a macro level, in terms of dollars, retail funds are maintaining market share, but it actually looks like industry funds and self-managed super are the ones that are gaining from the outflows from corporate funds and to some extent public sector funds. So a bit of a summary of the overall backdrop is that brand perception, you know, seems to be going more towards industry funds at the moment. Net switches is a mixed bag, and dollars, retail funds are maintaining market share, but it's the industry funds and self-managed super that seem to be gaining market share. Okay. Now, this isn't supposed to be a product flog, but just using it as a retail fund example. And First Choice, for those of you who don't know, that's the Colonial First State flagship platform Master Trust product. So let's have a look at investment performance first of all. This chart just shows you the value of $1,000 invested over the 3 years ended 31 December. That's the figure for industry funds, what it would have accumulated to according to the APRA data. And that's the figure for retail funds. And I think that's about a 2% per annum difference over that three-year period. Now, what we've done there is overlaid the First Choice Moderate portfolio. So First Choice Moderate, that's a multi-manager portfolio with a 60% allocation to growth assets. And the striking thing is that it looks very similar to the overall retail category. And then what that blue line is the first choice growth portfolio. Again, a multi-manager portfolio with an 80% allocation to growth assets. And again, surprisingly, looks very similar to the industry fund line, which is probably because they have a similar allocation to growth assets. And there's the first choice personal super line there, which is just slightly below. So that's the first choice if you look at the whole personal super product combined return. So there's a few sort of conclusions that you can draw from this. The first is that if you invest in first choice growth, 80-20 allocation, the performance is unbelievably similar to your average industry fund, so it looks pretty good. And the second thing is there's clearly something going on with asset allocation there, so it begs a bit of further investigation. Now turning to fees and looking at how first choice compares, that's a chart with the total ongoing percentage fee on the y-axis and account balances on the x-axis. And I've chosen to show first choice wholesale there because it's a product that doesn't have any commissions in, so you're comparing like with like. And it's only available for more than $100,000, so that's why that pink line of first choice wholesale starts at $100,000, surprisingly enough. And what you've got there is some of the big major industry funds and their fees. And what you can see is that the difference in fees is somewhere between 6 and 35 basis points over those balances. So a lot less than a lot of people would think, and compared to what you actually get in return is actually a pretty good deal, and I'll come back to that later. So the summary there is there is a retail fund in the market that looks pretty good on performance and fees relative to an industry fund. So we've proved the case for one particular product. Let's have a look at the industry data as a whole. Firstly, looking at investment performance, again going back to the APRA data. Now, the first thing to note here is actually the end column actually shows volatility, and already you can see that the volatility for retail funds is actually lower than that of industry funds. So, again, giving you some suggestion that there's something going on with asset allocation there. And then we need to look at what's going on in terms of the APRA data. What does the retail sector comprise? And if you look at it, it's actually got personal super in there, corporate super master trusts, and retirement incomes or allocated, and that's really predominantly allocated pension business. So the retail sector is actually an amalgamation of a whole load of different stuff, effectively. The corporate super master trust business would actually be very similar in profile to your industry fund or corporate fund type business, but a lot of people in the industry would know that personal super and the allocated pension business is likely to be quite different, actually. So why do the retail funds appear to underperform in the APRA data? It's predominantly due to strategic asset allocation, and we'll go through that in a bit of detail now, and also fees, which I'll cover. So the thing is, with personal super and allocated pensions, most of the business is recommended by financial advisors. It doesn't go into a default fund, and it's therefore a very different profile from your typical employer-sponsored type arrangement where it mostly goes into a default portfolio. So the retail fund asset allocation is actually the amalgamation of thousands of different decisions by investors. It's not a sort of single trustee-based decision, if you like. So in some ways, trying to compare the returns of that amalgamation of lots of decisions to, you know, your industry fund or corporate fund type arrangement, it's almost a meaningless comparison. And what you find is that retail funds on average have older clients, which to a large extent is intuitive if you think. When do people go and seek financial advice? They go when they're, you know, 10 years prior to retirement or at retirement. And just to illustrate that with our own business, the average age of our first choice employer super, so our corporate super master trust, is 35 years old, whereas the average age of the rest of our retail business is actually 49. And when you look at it on an asset-weighted perspective, the difference is actually even more stark. For our employer super business, 35% relates to, of the assets relate to over age 50, whereas with the rest of the retail business, it's actually 75% of assets relate to people over age 50. And hence, because the clients are older, they have a more conservative strategic asset allocation, which is borne out in part in the APRA data. As far as I know, APRA doesn't collect data for the asset allocation of the funds as a whole. They only collect for the default fund. And this data is just showing you the allocation to growth assets of the default funds. So you've got industry funds at 69% there and retail funds at 53%. And then there's another category, which is not clear what's actually in there, but even if you added that on, you'd get to 79% for industry funds and 71% for retail funds. So you've got a difference of between 7 and 16% allocation to growth assets between the two, which I think everyone would clearly understand that, that's going to drive the difference in returns. And this is a bit of a proxy for how much that would have affected returns over that three-year period. Just looking at the Chart West data for high growth funds versus growth funds, so there's approximately a 20% difference in allocation between those two different categories. Over that three-year period, that gave a 1.2% difference in returns. So we're not talking about a 20% difference in allocation to growth assets. We're talking about a 16% or lower. So it's approximately a 1%. That explains about a 1% difference in returns over that period. Then the other contributing factor is fees, because as far as I know, the performance is calculated after fees. So you've got the fee impact in there. So to try and quantify that, I've used the Rice Warner data. We've got Michael Rice at the front here, so he can answer any questions on his data. Now, this is actually quite old data. It's from 2006, because I understand that this survey will be re-released this year. Yep, he's nodding. So it gives you the effective expense rates for the various different types of superannuation fund. So, for example, industry funds are 1.13%. And then what I've done is, and the numbers in the brackets are the allowance for the cost of advice, typically the trail commission that's inbuilt into those products. If you calculate, and all of those different categories there are actually retail categories, so I calculated a weighted average of those fees and came up with 1.88%, and that includes that 50 basis points of advice. So if you look at the difference between the retail weighted average of 1.88 and the industry fund of 1.13, you get about 75 basis points difference in fees. And again, to stress, 50 basis points of that relates to advice. So again, of that 2% difference in return, we've explained 1% with strategic asset allocation and another 75 basis points with fees. So what happens when you do compare like with like? Now, for us, the most reliable source of data for this is the Chart West data, and that's because of their methodology. And I'll just two things to stress about this. Firstly, they put the right funds in the right sectors. So if a fund has got 80% allocation to growth assets, it goes into the high growth category, not into the growth category, into the balance category. And second of all, what they do is they calculate the performance net of investment fees, not net of the total fee. And again, that's really important because the administration fee can be going to pay for different higher services or more product features or advice or whatever it might be. It doesn't relate to the investment return. And what you can see there is the year-by-year returns for industry funds and master trusts. And what you actually see is that they've been unbelievably quite similar for most years. Now, that's actually not surprising because at the end of the day, when you compare multi-manager portfolios, strategic asset allocation is going to be the main driver of difference. They're all advised on by similar asset consultants. So everyone's using, you know, be you a retail fund or an industry fund, typically you're using Mercer's or Intech or Watson Wyatt or whoever. So you would actually expect over time that the performance of the multi-manager portfolios within the different segments is actually quite similar. What you can see, the 2 years that I've circled are the years where there has actually been quite a big difference in the returns, and the industry funds outperformed by about 3% in those years. So it's a good idea to have a look at what went on there. And this table shows you the returns in each of the calendar years for each of the major asset classes. And I think, and a lot of you will obviously know this, but the first thing to point out is the returns overall for global shares, 3.9% per annum for the last 10 years there. It's been the worst performing asset class, which clearly is an unusual occurrence. And also how good Aussie equities has been over that period. And for global shares, the two worst years were 2002 and 2007. And I've also circled the last year's their property securities number, because that was a pretty awful year as well. So then you come back to looking at the multi-manager portfolios and the difference in allocations that industry funds and retail funds have. And surprise, surprise, retail funds have a higher allocation to international equities. And my understanding is that's more because industry funds in the past have had a more philosophical leaning, for obvious reasons, towards Australian shares and property, for that matter. And I understand that that's actually been reducing over time. Industry funds actually have a higher allocation to alternative assets. I've got those numbers the wrong way around, by the way, the 4 and the 11. And a higher allocation to property. So, again, taking into consideration the very poor performance of international equities is why you don't expect the differences in performance of the multi-manager portfolios to be that different going forward in time. Probably the only difference that is sustainable is going to relate to alternative assets. But again, it's quite a small proportion of the overall portfolio. Okay, done investment performance. Let's move on to fees. Again, this is the Rice Warner data from 2006, slightly differently presented because now I've just shown the numbers at the various account balances, so 5,000, 20, and 50. And also I've stripped out the advice. So the figure that was in brackets before, I've taken out so that you're comparing like with like, you're comparing investment and administration fees. And what you can see, particularly the wholesale part of the market, is what relates to, you know, big employers. You can see that the number for corporate super master trust at 71 basis points and industry funds at 91, you know, very similar, and the corporate super master trust even cheaper at that level. And then in the retail segment, there's corporate super master trust again at 1.42, so slightly higher there. Also, you've got personal super and retirement income at 1.54 and 1.28 for a $50,000 balance. So slightly higher, and I'll come back to, you know, why those fees are higher in those parts, those segments of the market. But overall, if you compare employer super to employer super, particularly at the big end of town, and you strip out advice, you can see how competitive retail and industry funds are. And this is a point about comparing averages being misleading, again from the Rice Warner data. The lines here represent the range of fees being charged within that sector, and the dots the mean. And what you can see is that how much overlap there is between segments. So to use the mean of a segment and imply that therefore all funds in that segment are cheaper than all funds in another segment is actually quite misleading. And hopefully the first choice example that I showed you earlier evidences that. So really to drill a point home, the fee projections that are used in the industry fund ads at the moment, there's quite a few issues with them, which I'm going to take you through because I can. The first thing is that they don't allow for any corporate super master trust discounts or rebates that are paid. So they assume that the highest fee or the smallest employer, that's what they compare. So, for example, if you look at First Choice Employer Super, our RAC rate is 1.84% as the management fee. But the vast bulk of members get a discount on that based on the size of their employer, to the extent where the average fee that's actually charged is 1.38%, so about a 50 basis point difference between, so already half a percent there different, and that's a standard practice across the industry. The second thing is that they factor in the full cost of advice without attributing any value to that advice. So the fees that they use include the cost of advice or the trail commission that might be inbuilt, but don't attribute any value to that, and I'll come back to that just now. The third thing is they compare averages. As we saw, there's lots of variation, so comparing averages, you know, is not a great thing to do. And also, they're actually based on samples of the different funds. It's not the complete universe where those averages have been calculated. And also, retirement products for industry funds typically have higher prices than their employer super equivalents. So again, you start to muddy the waters when you get into retirement. And finally, they assume static fees, and a lot of us are aware there's data come out recently showing industry funds fees are increasing and retail fund fees reducing. So just a note on the value of advice. It is very difficult, as everyone here would appreciate, to quantify the value of advice, but FPA recently commissioned Rice Warner to quantify 8 different case studies. So they calculated the present value of the value for that advice, and that's actually... That's not my phone. Someone doesn't recognise their own ring. So the sort of, I don't know what colour you call that, crimsony colour bar is the present value of the value of advice. And that present value is incorporating all aspects of the value of that advice, be it strategic advice, greater investment returns, more contributions from the individuals, government support, so access to co-contributions or age pension. So just 2 extreme examples. For a young family building wealth, the value of that advice was put at over... the present value was put at over $300,000, and for a wealthier family building wealth, the value was put at over $600,000. Okay, so what else? Oh, yeah, this is the Alan Kohler one. So why don't... Oh, right, that's a bit funny there. So what else comes into the equation? We've looked at fees and we've looked at performance, but what else do you need to factor in? And the other way of asking this question is, why don't financial planners recommend industry funds? And... you know, the line that's had a lot of profile in the media is that it's because they don't pay commissions. And I'm not saying that that doesn't have any impact, because there is an element of that, and I'll come to that. But it is certainly by far and away not the most important reason. And the point I tried to make with Alan this morning was that there has actually been a real sea change in the last couple of years, so much so that... if you look at our retail net flows, over 100% are now going into products, i.e. first choice wholesale, that don't have any inbuilt commission. So this image or myth of all these commissions and the conflicts of interest that the advisor's only recommending that particular product because they're going to get a big whack of money out of it, what's actually happening is that they are now dialing up the fee. Complete transparency shows through on the member's statement. I personally would never have thought that would have happened so quickly. We've been talking about the trend towards fee for service for a long time, and it just happened. So where are the gaps? This is a bit of a laundry list, but I'll go through it. The first one is the sort of business strength or capital backing. So we have seen in recent times how a lot of the retail players have had to dip into their pockets to compensate for unit pricing errors to the tunes of tens of millions of dollars. We've been one of them. So the number of investment options. So on average, industry funds would have about 9 investment options compared to over 100 for retail. Just the equity and the transparency that comes with daily unit pricing, so your average industry fund, for at least for their main portfolio, would still use a crediting rate approach. The equity associated with insurance premium rates based on gender, age and occupation. So still with a lot of industry funds, there's a lot of cross-subsidisation goes on. Insurance cover, particularly access to salary continuance insurance. Functionality to match planning strategy. So one example of that is binding death benefit nominations, but one area where it's sort of there's a lot of activity at the moment is transition to retirement, so from personal super to allocated pensions. Reporting timeframe, so we get our statements out within 2 weeks of the end of the period, compared to between 3 and 6 months often for industry funds. We process transactions within a day, applications, redemptions, switches, access to online transactions. There I've said advisor remuneration flexibility, so be that via an inbuilt commission or via a dial-up fee, you have to allow for that within a product. And increasingly industry funds are doing that. And then there's a whole liaison with research houses that goes on. So data, performance data, ratings, information on all of the investment options that is absolutely critical for the advice process. But the real sleeper in all of this is what I've called here B2B infrastructure, and it's probably for people outside the industry the most least understood part of the retail platform, if you like. So from our point of view, a key part of the whole first choice offer is the internet front end that the advisor can access client data through. So examples of that, online advisor tools, and particularly advisor reporting. So, for example, on First Choice, the advisor can actually access 20 different kinds of reports on their client data, and they can actually customise their own reports. So, for example, they can run a report on who's got insurance cover, or who's done a transaction in the last 6 months, or who's in the perpetual industrial share fund. If they've got a client coming to their office the next day for a review, they can print out a status report of that client's current situation. And the final one is data feeds to financial planning software, so COIN, Xplan, Visy. Again, that's what advisors sit with every day, and we download data into those to that software so that the advisor has access to that and can see up-to-date data on balances and transactions and that sort of thing. And that's just a couple of screenshots in terms of that B2B support. So, like, just to illustrate, it's a really good user-friendly interface for advisors. Okay, to conclude. So, yes, in the APRA data, it looks like retail funds underperformed, but it's because they have a lower allocation to growth assets. It's very, very explainable. And also fees, which a large component of it relates to financial advice, which hopefully demonstrated the value of. And if you compare like with like with multi-manager portfolios, we are likely to see very similar outcomes, I think, going forward. And any differences can be easily explained by international equities in particular, but also alternative assets and also the difference between listed and unlisted property over the last year. The fee differences, if you compare employer super to employer super, particularly at the big end of town, the fee differences, you know, are almost non-existent. The biggest variation is the cost of financial advice, so you have to start looking at what value people are getting for that. And in terms of the remaining difference in terms of fees, I hopefully demonstrated a long list of the additional value that you get for that. Okay, so in short, you do need to look behind the numbers, and particularly at the methodologies that are being used. And just a bit of a comment on who will win. It is my firm view that it actually won't be one particular sector against the other. It'll actually be the good funds within each are the ones that will actually win, and I think we're seeing that already. Thank you very much.
Ray Murray, as a employee of an industry superannuation fund, I have to come back and make some comments. I'm staggered that you do a fee comparison and make a comment that at the big end of town they're like for like, and do not deal with somebody transitioning to a big end, a personal division in a retail fund, and have their fees go up by 1%. So that's a standard practice that operates at the big end of town. So you're not doing that. The other thing I'm intrigued by is that you've not looked through fees. So a number of the consultants, Chant West in particular, are now analysing the quoted fee, and there are very, very big differences in how those fees get constructed. So for us as an industry fund, for instance, we have a big component in alternate assets, and we bring all those alternate assets up into our top-end price, and we do not have fund-of-funds burying fees. So I don't think you can be credible until you actually look down into that next layer and start to show those sort of statistics. The third thing is that on the averages, you quoted a fee of Colonial First State and then went and used different data to suit your purpose and your argument. So you used Rice Warner data at one point to say, yes, they're on averages, and I don't like averages, but I'm happy to use that and do those comparisons. So I don't think there is a really credible like-for-like comparison in the process. In terms of your gaps analysis, certainly for us as an industry fund, again, you've used averages. We, down your list, the only time I sort of parted company was when you got down to the distribution method, which is via financial planners, everything else we did. So I don't think, again, that's a fair comparison to generalise on an industry fund and say, for instance, they use interest rates when clearly people like us have used unit prices.
Yeah, okay. So on the first point, I need a point. So the jump to when people leave, that's a valid comment. So retail funds do often put their fees up to the retail level when they leave their employer. So, yep, accept that. Your second point was, I've got expenses here. So actually, Chant West has just released a report on that, highlighting the fact that there are buried levels of fees in fund-of-fund structures. And I would be very interested to see, as far as I know, there isn't actually any credible data available that actually does. He's just sort of started to raise that issue. But my point would be, actually, because industry funds have more alternative assets, they're actually more likely to be hiding more of the fees than the retail sector. And then in terms of the list, I definitely acknowledge your point about some industry funds. You know, Sun Super, for example, would come very close to your average retail fund, and with that list of things that I read through, some industry funds do come close, but again, I am comparing the average, but you know, you did it first. So. but yeah, totally acknowledge that there are some very good industry funds out there that do a lot of those things, absolutely. And there was one other point that you made that me using different data to suit my needs. So was that when I used the one set of Rice Warner data and then a different set later on?
You used your 0.3% gap and said therefore fees are okay, and then if you used Rice Warner and said there's a 75 basis point gap.
Yes, because so what I was trying to illustrate up front is that there are retail funds out there that are very competitive, but then what I was trying to do was go to an industry level, and the 0.75 is actually the industry level gap between retail and, whereas the example I'd used before was just a particular retail fund. I don't think you can have a go at me on that one. Okay, any other questions?
Hi, Melinda House. I thought it was a very, very interesting presentation, Nicolette. One thing that I guess concerned me a little was when you were talking about the differences in asset allocation and the outcome of all those individual advice or individual consumer decisions in a retail fund is a much lower asset allocation, even though the clients are older.
Yeah.
Is that really the right outcome? And I know that's not something that is in the retail funds control, but I guess it's an issue for the advice industry that are they being a little too conservative in the asset allocations that they help clients reach?
Yeah. Certainly, if you'd have asked me 2 years ago what's more aggressively invested, retail funds or industry funds, I would have said retail funds, just because on average, you know, for your average client at a similar age, going to an advisor would typically put them up the risk spectrum. So, but I think it's because they are so much older that you're getting that outcome. But it is a good point.
Some questions we prepared earlier. Picking up on Alan Kohler and your discussion with him this morning, he's quite keen to see separation of advice from everything, obviously, and questioning the value of it. And one of the points he raised was that Colonial shouldn't own a financial planning firm, or any other large institution, whether that's an industry fund or a retail fund, should not therefore supply advice. And I think this question applies both to retail and industry funds who are actively building their own in-house financial planning teams. They presumably, under Alan's rule, are just as conflicted as a retail fund that has its own advice team. Do you want to comment on that at a personal level?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally disagree with Alan's point there, and I think you have to get over the conflicts of interest and look at the end consumer outcome. So your average Australian's better off because financial institutions own financial planning firms, and I having watched the process within the Commonwealth Bank structure, absolutely agree that they are better off because of the sort of accessibility and affordability of advice via that structure. And yes, there are conflicts of interest, but you have to manage them. So we manage the conflicts of interest is the key point. You look at the process of somebody walking in through the Commonwealth Bank door, going to a Commonwealth Bank financial planner. They don't think that they're an independent guy. They've just walked into the Commonwealth Bank. He's wearing a Commonwealth Bank uniform. And then they get a financial plan and they are typically invested in a first choice portfolio. The cost of the advice is very reasonable and they're put into a really good product. And I absolutely think that the end outcome for that consumer is superior to if they didn't ever access that advice in the first place, which would likely be the case if, you know, banks and even industry funds didn't provide that accessibility to advice. So I think it's about the thing is that it assuming that there's a conflict of interest, it assumes that you are going to do the wrong thing by the consumer at the end of the day, and that is, you know, we're running a business, we're not going to do the wrong thing by the consumer because we want them to come back. So I think that argument of you shouldn't be offering advice because there's a conflict of interest is actually, you know, very flawed because you know the businesses that will win in the long term are the ones that are consumer focused.
I'm going to be a bit more tactful than Ray. Couple of things. I think that using the APRA data for retail is problematic completely because in retail it does cover the corporate master trust, so you can actually draw almost any conclusion you want to out of the data. But I'm not sure how you get around that. But I think using the APRA data on using percentages on fees, especially in 2006 when the average super fund balance was probably $2,000 or $3,000 and the average master trust was probably $40,000 or $50,000, sort of locks in this paradigm that we think about where we think about fees for bips versus dollars. And that was a point I think Alan Kohler was making, is that unless you get out of that paradigm, we're going to think 1% might be cheap, but it might not be cheap for $1 million. So I said that paradigm. That's the first thing. The second thing is the whole issue is the 0.5%. I think the issue he was making was we're sort of saying that the advice costs 0.5%, therefore we can take it out. Well, that's the whole issue. The issue is the 0.5% and whether everybody's getting the value for that and how you measure the value on that. And I think we can all assume that the wholesale, underlying wholesale returns are going to be the same and you can adjust for asset allocation. The issue isn't that. The issue is everything else, the member fee, the advice and everything that piles on top of that because, I mean, you are giving advice to industry funds and you are giving advice to the Commonwealth Bank super funds as well. So, it is a level playing field, I think, on the wholesale side. It's just not level on the retail side. And I think the biggest issue is this jump that you, as a personal member, as soon as you retire, your fee goes up to 1% or 2%. That's, I think, the key issue in a lot of this. So,
So they're comments, not questions. But that's fine. and I guess just making that point that sort of Alan Kollock sort of talked about the 2% fee in a retail fund, and in putting up the first choice wholesale data, I was trying to emphasise that, you know, there's retail funds out there where the fee is 1%, not 2%. So, hopefully if you just remember one thing, just remember that.
Stephen Woods. Nicolette, thank you for the presentation. I thought you made a valiant attempt to explain the underperformance of retail versus industry funds. If I can summarise the key points, though, just the two issues that you summarised it into were that, in your opinion, the investment performance could be explained by asset allocation. If that was the case, wouldn't we see during different periods of market that the retail funds would outperform in some circumstances and industry in others? And secondly, on the fees issue, I would have thought that philosophically, where a fund is effectively paying for shareholders' wealth, that they would be at a disadvantage compared to industry funds, where all of the profits obviously go to the members. In particular, you stripped out the cost of advice, but a number of the major industry funds actually provide advice within those costs already or at a subsidised level. So I'd like your comments on that, particularly in light, I guess, of you've used the average costs, but there's a research study by the AIST which looked at individual funds and actually showed that in terms of fees, the cheapest retail fund was actually just below the median industry fund.
Different times would different funds outperform? Absolutely. But what we've actually seen over the last 10 years is an unbelievably bad 10 years for international equities. So they're obviously, international equities are supposed to be the best performing asset class over time, and they've actually been the worst. So, and since we've only got really 10 years of reasonable data, we're looking at a very unusual period where Australian equities and property have actually performed very strongly as well. So I do think that's why I make the point that going forward, you know, depending if international equities suddenly perform much better, then the retail funds would perform much better. That's a bit of a philosophical question. The next one about where the cost of shareholder value and the paying the profits would therefore mean that retail fees will always be higher. But that's a whole efficiency argument about the whole capitalism structure, which I think we'll leave for another day. And I guess your mention of that AIST study, which I'm not aware of actually, but that would prove my point about the variability actually. So I'd be interested in looking at that.
A point of information. My name is Ramani. I'm from APRA. Point of information and perhaps a tongue-in-cheek suggestion. The information is on 2nd of July, APRA is organising a consultation conference on how data collection for superannuation can be improved and, dare I say, made more granular. There is obviously a tension between preserving the confidentiality and privacy of people who provide data to APRA and making data more available so that some of the issues which have been pointed out here and other fora are better addressed. So that's on 2nd of July. The tongue-in-cheek suggestion is that our system allows for a whole range of models to operate, and without preferring one model over the other, the regulator has the responsibility to disclose whatever information is available so that people can make informed decisions. As has been pointed out, the retail model, the trustee is owned by a shareholder, there is a natural tension. I wonder whether the picture could be clarified if institutions who provide data can, on their own, provide an idea of how much capital they have really invested in this business and how much return they make in relation to super, other wealth management, their banking, life insurance, or general insurance. This kind of data would be available internally. A CFO worth his or her salt would not be earning their wage if they do not know that. How does it compare in the wealth management business with other businesses? I think that would be a very useful statistic. Perhaps in further defense of the position which different people might have about their own industries, it's something which they should bring up. Sunlight, as they say, is the best disinfectant. Thank you.
I think we'll let Nicolette off the hook now. Thank you for dealing with quite a wide range of questions, comments and opinions. You did quite handle that very well. And it was quite an interesting presentation. And if people take up Romani's offer to supply their views to APRA on how to collect and report data, I'm sure that would be most welcome outcome from today's forum. Would you please join me in thanking Nicolette?